You're listening to the Statelessness and Exclusion Dialogues podcast, brought to you by the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion. I'm your host, Andy Clark. In this podcast series, we're trying to better understand the link between structural discrimination and statelessness in the world today. We're looking at different themes, including the history of colonialism, patriarchy, state formation, xenophobia and racism, and digital ID and documentation. In the series, we speak to a diverse range of experts from around the world. In this episode, we look at patriarchy and its impact on statelessness.
In some countries, there are, while women don't have the right to pass citizenship to their children, in instances where men do, the women may apply to ask the government to give their child citizenship. And we see all too frequently that if you are coming from a quote-unquote undesirable group, if you're not coming from the majority group of the country, if you're not perhaps elite with good connections, it is very, very unlikely that you will be able to secure citizenship for your child in many of these countries. My name is Catherine Harrington. I am the manager of the Global Campaign for Equal Nationality Rights, which is a coalition of national and international organizations, independent activists, and UN partner agencies housed at Women's Refugee Commission.
I think one key aspect of the campaign, which has changed me tremendously, is the focus on empowering affected individuals, capacity building, so empowering affected mothers to rise up, to speak, to share their stories, to advocate for change for their children, you know, for all women in the country. Hi, I am Patricia Low, and I am from Malaysia. I am a writer, a mother of two, and an advocate from the Family Frontiers Mothers Network.
So, Catherine, we're talking about patriarchy and its influence on statelessness. Can you just give us a brief example to kick off the conversation today? You know, tell me in a nutshell something that encapsulates this problem.
When we're talking about patriarchy and statelessness, we immediately think of the fact that there are still today 24 countries that have nationality laws that deny women the right to confer citizenship on their children on an equal basis with men. There are 49 countries that have nationality laws that deny women the right to confer citizenship on a non-citizen spouse on an equal basis with men. And this gender discrimination in nationality laws is a tragic and glaring example of the legacy of patriarchy in our societies and in our legal systems today. When you think about this gender discrimination and nationality laws at its core, these laws are reflecting the state's position, essentially that women are unequal citizens, that their citizenship is not of equal value to male citizens. And when you think about the kind of conceptual background of this, these laws, these discriminatory laws, they're grounded with this understanding that national identity, that family identity, quote-unquote, naturally come from men. That's the definition of patriarchy. So I think of gender discrimination and nationality laws as really kind of the canary in the coal mine for a framework that undermines women's equal citizenship.
Patricia, let me turn to you. Can you just give me a brief example of, you know, something that encapsulates this issue for you?
Okay, so as Catherine has shared just now, gender discriminatory nationality laws are patriarchal in nature and its roots, and that's the case for Malaysia. So Malaysia is still one of the 24 countries that still uphold unequal citizenship laws. And for in the case of Malaysia, the law that's enshrined in the federal constitution explicitly states that for births that occur outside the country, only fathers, so it's very clear, it says only fathers can pass down citizenship by operation of law, that is automatically. And this is also a legacy of our colonial past, established by our colonial powers and carried over since independence 66 years ago. So it hasn't changed since then. And I think this is even more striking because Malaysia has actually ratified CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And they have even amended the Constitution in 2001 to prohibit gender discrimination.
And what sort of impact does this have in practice then in people's everyday lives? Perhaps, Patricia, you can give an example of how this impacts people.
Absolutely. It permeates every part of life. It makes even the simplest things, daily tasks, it makes it very difficult. So as we understand, citizenship is the gateway to fundamental human rights. And so without citizenship, it is very difficult to access healthcare, education, you know, things that we all take for granted, things that we all need in our everyday lives. There is a lot of stress, a lot of uncertainty, because without citizenship, the status of the child is uncertain. The future of the child is uncertain.
And Catherine, do you have some examples of the impact on daily life of this, of, you know, gender discrimination in nationality laws?
Sure. I mean, and I can think of so many examples where it not only illustrates the impact on the individual, but on society as a whole. So, you know, I'm thinking of one, a young Nepali woman who was born in Nepal to a Nepali mother, born and raised there, never lived anywhere else, and yet she was stateless. She had no nationality at all. Nepal didn't count her citizen. She had no citizenship anywhere. She was a fantastic student. She excelled and really wanted to become a doctor. She was at the top of her class. And yet, because of her stateless status, she was unable to take the exams that were required for her to enter medical school. You know, you have a country like Nepal that is working to develop and to have and build a more prosperous society. And you have these discriminatory, archaic laws that are holding individuals back and they're holding the country back. I know another family also in Nepal where the woman actually met and married her Dutch husband, but she said, "I'll only marry you if we can raise our family inside Nepal. I want to contribute to my country." Family was, you know, well-resourced. The kids got a great education and her two children really wanted to build a life in Nepal. They didn't have access to citizenship there, so they ended up working in international careers, being quite successful abroad, and that's a loss for the country.
Patricia, you mentioned the story of Mimi in the preparation for the podcast. Maybe you could tell us Mimi's story.
So there is a Malaysian mother in our group. Her name is Mimi. She has a daughter who is stateless, as her spouse is a refugee and only holds a travel document. So her daughter is only a travel document holder. So now the family resides abroad, but Mimi recently had to fly back to Malaysia to give birth because she is pregnant. And this is to avoid her coming child, to avoid that child being stateless. And as you know, flying during pregnancy, it's a lot of risks and complications. And that's a burden that this law places upon women to undertake. And there's also questions of whether her child, her daughter, her stateless daughter, can remain in the country for as long as she needs to. So there was a lot of stress and uncertainty as to whether she would have to leave her daughter behind. So as far as I know, she has managed to bring her daughter into the country. However, she now faces a dilemma as immigration would not allow the daughter any visa or any permit for long-term residence. So she is here temporarily.
Okay, so that's obviously a very real everyday impact of these laws. Catherine, why are these laws still so prevalent? Why are they still, on the books, as it were? And why are we still seeing the repercussions of these laws, you know, in 2023?
Yeah, I mean, I think Patricia earlier raised an important point that these laws do have a colonial legacy. We see in the only 49 countries, that's both way too many, and you can see that there's also been progress. But in many of these countries were former colonies that at the time of independence, they based their nationality laws on the normative nationality law at the time, in the 60s, in the last century, which at that time across the world, in the UK, in France, in countries across the world, gender discrimination and nationality laws was unfortunately the norm. So happily, most countries have enacted reforms, understanding that women and men deserve their equal citizenship to be enshrined in all laws, including nationality laws, and that it benefits society as a whole. In countries where the laws were reformed, the activists that were calling on policymakers to change these laws showed really concrete examples, like Patricia just did, of how these laws were harmful. In the countries where these laws persist, there are a lot of myths about the threats that gender equal nationality laws pose. There's a lot of fears. There's a lot of xenophobia. There's a lot of concern that, quote unquote, allowing women to pass citizenship to their children, to their spouse on an equal basis with men, will encourage more foreigners to get citizenship. And there's a reactionary element in countries around the world where there's a desire by some elements in society to keep the others out. All of this relies on an understanding that it's acceptable to deny women equal rights with men. So no one questions men's right to pass citizenship to their child, regardless of where the mother comes from. So you really have this kind of interaction of xenophobia and sexism, and civil society groups on the ground are working hard. Policymakers that understand that gender equal nationality rights are just are working hard, and we're hopeful, as we're seeing progress in countries around the world, that these discriminatory laws will be eliminated in the near future.
You mentioned there briefly, that xenophobia and sexism were kind of used and utilized to defend these laws still. And do you have examples of that? What is said to justify this still?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the sexism, what we hear in many of these contexts is, well, the women made their choice. They elected to marry a foreign man or a stateless man, as it may be in some circumstances. So you're really also hitting on here the way that these laws deny women's right to equally choose a spouse, to freely choose a spouse. So there's an element of this that's really about control and controlling women's choices in their lives that, again, is not applied to men. These laws at the same time are responsible for family separation. You have instances in countries such as a number of them in the Gulf, where when a child is unable to get their mother's nationality, they're not even allowed to remain in the country in many instances after they turn 18 years old. They have to get a sponsor from an employer like anybody else, even if they've never lived anywhere else besides that their mother's country. In terms of examples of xenophobia, really comes across when you hear arguments why nationality laws can't be reformed. For example, you hear in Nepal from those that are opposed to reform, well, we're a small country. Our neighboring countries are trying to invade the country through the womb. You hear things like that. And what we really need to do is we need policymakers and the public to understand that this is a question of equal citizenship, and this is a question of children's rights, and gender equal nationality laws are essential to sustainable development and to these countries' futures.
Patricia, how would you like to react to what Catherine's just said?
I absolutely agree. What Catherine has said is also seen in the Malaysian context. So as I've shared earlier, the story of mothers like Mimi, a lot of us are on the receiving end of hateful comments and criticism. Again, the blame is laid on the shoulders of the women. We are blamed for marrying a foreign spouse. Those who have stateless children, the blame is put on them. Why did you allow your children to be stateless? You have brought it upon yourself and your child. And the fault is placed on the shoulders of the women when it should be on gender discriminatory laws and policies.
Have you experienced this personally as well then?
I'm not affected by statelessness. but as a mother who is in the forefront of the campaign against this law in Malaysia, the mothers who are involved do get a healthy dose of abusive comments and criticisms from absolute strangers online. But also, sadly, depending on which demographic you are from in the country, you will also face resistance from family and friends.
Catherine, what's your response to that?
Again, a tragic similarity that we see across countries with these discriminatory laws is the intersection of discrimination against minority groups and the application of gender discrimination and nationality laws, whether that's ethnic or religious minorities in a country. In some countries, there are, while women don't have the right to pass citizenship to their children in instances where men do, the women may apply to ask the government to give their child citizenship. And we see all too frequently that when this is the case, when it's left to the discretion of the government, that if you are coming from a quote-unquote undesirable group, if you're not coming from the majority group of the country, if you're not perhaps elite with good connections, it is very, very unlikely that you will be able to secure citizenship for your child in many of these countries. There's also, of course, an intersection with displacement and the impact of gender discrimination and nationality laws. Many of the countries that still have these laws are either countries that have large refugee populations or countries that are presently hosting refugees. So again, you see this overlaid with discrimination against displaced populations. For example, in Lebanon, you have a large refugee population. You have a Syrian population and a Palestinian population, in addition to the presence of different religious groups with inside the country. These factors are used to justify Lebanese women's inability to confer citizenship on their children. You've even had bills suggested by government leaders where they propose that, well, maybe women can pass citizenship to their children, but not if the father is Syrian or Palestinian. So completely discriminatory proposals, like layering on to the discrimination against women. And again, in these contexts, you do not see any thought to deny men the right to pass citizenship to their children. That is considered to be a natural right. So again, coming back to the patriarchy, the patriarchal mindset that is at the root of these laws.
Can it also play out in different ways as well, leading to issues like gender-based violence? Catherine, can you speak to that?
Tragically, gender discrimination and nationality laws is linked with multiple forms of gender-based violence. One example, we know that stateless girls are at an increased risk of child marriage. We have the case of a young Lebanese girl who was stateless, Lebanese in the sense that she was born and raised in Lebanon to a Lebanese mother, but without citizenship. Her father was stateless. And because of her insecure status, her family, tragically, like we've seen with other families, sometimes view early marriage as a route to securing identity documents and citizenship for their daughters. So families approach this as a protection mechanism, which is really just another form of gender discrimination and violence against those young girls.
How old was she?
I believe at the time of when she was engaged to the man, she was around 14 years old. Gender discrimination and nationality laws also makes it even more difficult in many instances for women to try to extract themselves from abusive relationships. So we have many examples of women who marry a foreign man, perhaps they raise a family in their spouse's country, and they find themselves in an abusive relationship. What does that mean? It's hard enough to try and extract oneself from a situation like that. What does it mean when your children don't even have access to citizenship in your own country? What if your citizenship in some countries, when a woman naturalizes and acquires her foreign spouse's citizenship, there are some laws where that woman could lose nationality if she elects to get a divorce when she acquired nationality through marriage. But I think it's really important to stress, and there are other links with human trafficking, with women and girls in the workplace that don't have access to documentation and nationality in the country where they work are at increased risk of exploitation and violence in the workplace. But I think fundamentally, anybody that works on gender-based violence understands that the root cause of gender-based violence, any form of gender-based violence, is women's unequal status in society and in the family. So by gender discrimination in nationality laws perpetuating women's unequal status as citizens and in the family, they are directly contributing to an environment that is conducive to gender-based violence.
Patricia, let me turn to you. You're working with a group to try and fight back against gender discriminatory nationality laws in Malaysia. Tell us about your group and what your particular focus is.
So the campaign in Malaysia to fight against gender discriminatory citizenship laws is being run by an NGO called Family Frontiers. And it is backed, supported by a group of mothers who are affected by these laws, just like me. And we work to advocate for reform in the political sphere. We do a lot of work raising awareness among the public, civil society, through events, through social media. I think one key aspect of the campaign, which has changed me tremendously, is the focus on empowering affected individuals, capacity building, so empowering affected mothers to rise up, to speak, to share their stories, to advocate for change for their children, you know, for all women in the country. And there's also a focus on sharing of our lived realities, of our own personal experiences. And I think that is a very powerful.
Tell us more about some of the specific things you've been working on.
So in addition to the campaign, Family Frontiers and Six Mothers have filed a lawsuit against the government in 2020 to seek a declaration that Malaysian women married to foreigners have the right under the federal constitution for their overseas-born children to have the right to be called Malaysian citizens. Now, the case won at the High Court, but the decision was overturned at the Court of Appeal. As it stands now, it will proceed to the federal court, the Apex Court. I think this has garnered a lot of exposure for us, a lot of awareness on the issue. I think it's something that a lot of the public may not be aware of such situations, of such discriminatory laws. So I think it worked well to also bring about public support for this.
So you have the feeling there is a public support and there's been a positive reaction?
Well, actually, I have some good news, some positive updates, actually. Just last weekend, the cabinet of the current government in power announced that they are in agreement to proceed with an amendment to the constitution to allow Malaysian mothers equal rights as men to pass on citizenship to their foreign-born children. Now, this is a significant move. It is a move I think I personally did not foresee happening this soon. But we are very encouraged and we absolutely welcome the move by the government and we look forward to see it come to pass to fruition completely. It still needs to go through some parliamentary processes, but we are hopeful and we trust that the people in power will do what is right.
What did you do when you heard that news?
I may have cried. I think it's a mixture of disbelief, a mixture of relief as well, because it has been such a long journey, feelings of elation, of joy. It's a mixed bag. But also feeling slightly strange in a sense because we have faced so much resistance and objection over the years from previous governments. And to hear this, it's quite a remarkable thing.
I also want to reflect on what Patricia just said. I mean, the fight that Patricia and other affected mothers have been waging simply for equal rights, simply for the same rights that men automatically have. And Patricia is actually being incredibly modest. The campaign that she and other affected mothers and Family Frontiers has led over the past several years has been absolutely extraordinary. It is a textbook example of how when affected mothers come together with allies, you actually have a government agreeing that they will put forward an amendment to the Constitution. That is, I mean, it should have been done a long time ago, but what they've been able to achieve in the past few years has been absolutely extraordinary. And when you asked about public support, they've done such an amazing job with outreach across the spectrum to the public, to media. In the most recent elections in Malaysia, you actually had politicians across the political spectrum, even those from the party that had been opposing reforms in the previous government, saying that this issue is a priority and that we need to be taking this forward and looking at addressing this problem. So I think we're very encouraged at the Global Campaign for Equal Nationality Rights by the work that our coalition members, that affected mothers and youth and feminist activists in the countries where these discriminatory laws remain, in the work that they've been doing. We have seen reforms in recent years. Liberia is the most recent country to enact reforms to comprehensively remove gender discrimination in the nationality law. So if we had this conversation several months ago, I'd be talking about 25 countries where women can't equally confer on children. Now we're down to 24. In the past several years, we saw similar reforms in Madagascar and Sierra Leone, where women now have the equal right to confer nationality on their children. In Togo, there is a bill that has been drafted that comprehensively eliminates gender discrimination in the nationality law. Now we just need to see it go to parliament and pass. We have Eswatini, a small country in southern Africa. That's the only country left in southern Africa where women don't have the right to confer citizenship on their children. The government has made an official pledge at a UN forum in 2019 to amend the nationality law to uphold women's equal right to confer citizenship on their children. So we are working with colleagues, activists in Eswatini in hopes that we can see concrete action in Eswatini soon. In the Bahamas, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Nepal, like I mentioned before, there are really robust campaigns that are being led by affected families, feminist actors, and civil society organizations. And, you know, we have to be honest that in many of the countries that are left, it is incredibly difficult. In many of the countries that remain, they're not democracies. So you can't have the same level of freedom of speech, of association, of, you know, electing independent leaders to government that can address this issue. So it's a much more challenging situation. But even in some of those countries where we don't have the same openness for civil society, like in the Gulf states, you have governments from UAE to Bahrain to Saudi Arabia talking about their goals for their countries as modern nations. They want to be leaders, and they talk about women's empowerment. This issue needs to be addressed. Citizens need to have the equal right to pass citizenship to their children and spouses. You don't get women's empowerment without that. That is essential. You don't build modern thriving societies without having laws that are inclusive and respect women and men's equal citizenship.
If you were asked to draw up the balance, though, would you say that things are moving in a positive direction now? You came with lots of positive examples there, but obviously it's not everywhere that things are moving. But is it possible to sort of draw up the balance and say which way, in general, things are going?
Things are definitely moving in a positive direction. The more information people have anywhere about this issue, and the more educated and the more as youth, you know, as each new generation is coming up, I think there is a greater understanding that not just on this issue, that humans deserve to be treated equally, that women and men deserve to be treated equally. I don't want to sound naive. There are still massive barriers, but things are moving in the right direction. And I think for those countries where there is less progress, they're increasingly outliers. The number of countries on this list with gender discrimination and nationality laws is going down every year. I just named a few when it comes to conferral on children. There are many that have enacted reforms in the past several years to uphold women's equal right to confer nationality on their spouse because they'd already addressed the issue with children. That includes Malawi, Lesotho. So things are moving in the right direction, and there is increasingly at the regional and at the global level momentum and attention to address this issue as a fundamental question of women's equal citizenship, children's rights, and essential to achieving sustainable development.
Patricia, are you positive when you've achieved things there, as you say? You must be feeling positive about the future. What's your biggest challenge in the short term?
I am feeling positive, but also cautious because nothing is certain until our children hold in their hands their citizenship certificates and identity cards. So it's still uncertain, but we are hopeful. We still have parliamentary processes. It still has to be tabled in parliament. We still need to have 2/3 of the vote in both upper and lower houses. And because it's a citizenship matter, we also need a consent from the Council of Rulers. So there is still a lot of processes, a lot of steps to undergo that we have to see through. But we trust that we work as well. We will keep on working. In this last leg, we will put in all we've got. There are plans to engage with MPs prior to tabling and voting. I think it's a lot of participation in the democratic process, which we are looking forward to, and to see change come.
Let me ask you both. I'll ask you first, Patricia. What's the overarching takeaway you'd like somebody to take away from listening to this podcast?
I think early on, Catherine has shared about the good work being done by feminist activists, women's rights groups, in leading reform efforts around the globe. And that's key. You know, advocating, intervening, campaigning, educating, as, you know, structures, as we understand it, structures do need to change. But I think alongside with that is also the role of the individual, the everyday person, like you, me, our neighbor, our family and our friends. I think many of us, myself included, we carry baggage from patriarchal structures and systems. And some are so deeply embedded in our subconscious that we don't stop to think why things are done a certain way. We don't question why things are implemented or done a certain way or practiced a certain way, and we continue doing it. But we need to question it. We need to challenge it. So I think a quick example in Malaysia would be a lot of people equate citizenship with lineage and surnames. So they connect the dots in this way that if the surname follows the father, citizenship must follow the father. But are those two things necessarily the same? They are not. And that's a long discussion that we can go into that. I think there's a lot of understanding that needs to be challenged, a lot of preconceived ideas and concepts that needs to be challenged. And it starts with the individual, with us, the person.
Catherine, same question to you. What's the overarching takeaway you'd like someone to have from listening to this podcast discussion?
Well, I think Patricia put it so beautifully in terms of the role for the individual and for people to be speaking out, and especially in the countries where gender discriminatory nationality laws remain, talking to as many people as you can about why these laws are wrong, why they're harmful. And I think governments must understand that there's no justification for gender discrimination in nationality laws. Women and men are equal citizens, and this needs to be enshrined in nationality laws. It's the right thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. It's 2023. We can and we will live in a world where nationality laws uphold citizens' equality. and it's time that we get there. And this is something that shouldn't be feared, but embraced, because it's good for families, it's good for countries, and it's just.
Thank you both very much for taking part in the podcast.
Thank you so much, Andy. I appreciate your attention to this issue.
You've been listening to the Statelessness and Exclusion Dialogues podcast, brought to you by the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion. The series examines different themes impacting statelessness, including the history of colonialism, patriarchy, state formation, xenophobia and racism, and digital ID and documentation. Today we were talking about patriarchy and its impact on statelessness. Our thanks go to our guests, Patricia Lowe and Catherine Harrington. If you'd like to know more about the work of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion, then visit the website, institutesi.org. That's institutesi.org. I'm Andy Clark. Thanks for listening.